This is Audible.
Last and First Men by Olaf Stapledon. Read by Stephen Greif. Forward. In 1930, a gentle, philosophically inclined Englishman finished writing an odd book and managed to get it published. Though it dealt with the far future in a way that was quite original, nobody considered it to be science fiction. Though it was a cool condensate of pure imagination, surely it wasn't a novel. After all, novels have characters and incidents, talk and action. This book instead moved forward with a grave, repetitive solemnity, without even a nod toward the human context of coffee breaks and the news of the day, office rivalries and a good evening out on the town. Seen from this book's perspectives, only the essential sweeping functions of humanity in the large mattered. It received good reviews from the major literary pundits of the day. "As original as the solar system," Hugh Walpole commented. Arnold Bennett cited the tremendous and beautiful imagination. A politician bumped from office and relying on writing for his income wrote a praising review. Winston S. Churchill appreciated its scope. Not that the author totally neglected his tortured times. "I have tried to make that story relevant to the change that is taking place today in man's outlook," he remarked in his preface. "I have imagined the triumph of the cruder sort of Americanism over all that is best and most promising in American culture." He evidently hoped to tie his grand-scale speculations to current great power politics to find an early turning point in the long drama of man. Interestingly, this is precisely what makes the book, not a novel perhaps, but surely science fiction, seem awkward and naive in its opening movements. Olaf Stapledon proved to be completely wrong about the near term. Virtually everything he says about America and Germany is startlingly off base. He seems to have had a smouldering dislike of both nations. Germany, because of World War I, and America because it embodied capitalism in the eyes of everyone. His Marxism, which remained his only irrational faith throughout his life, told him that surely the United States could never be a positive influence. Ironically, and with comic justice, this first complete edition of Last and First Men in over half a century is being published by an American firm, following on a strikingly successful fresh edition of Star Maker, Stapledon's masterpiece. But if he was wrong in matters of near interest, he was plentifully powerful when the larger canvas opened before him. Stapledon had studied the principal scientific discovery of the 19th century, the Darwin-Wallace idea of evolution, and projected it onto the vast scale of our future, envisioning the progression of intelligence as another element in the natural scheme. In his hands, the pressures of environment became the blunt facts of planetary evolution, the dynamics of worlds. He had followed the theories recently developed by astronomers, which described the physical evolution of stars from early compression to final death throes, the slow, massive workings of red giants and white dwarfs. This ability to take the ideas of the era and forge them into a new secular vision marked Stapledon as wholly original. But his view was not what we usually mean by humanistic. Schopenhauer's philosophy of being and Spengler's somewhat clockworky mechanisms of cyclic history run through this work. Man is not the measure of all things in this stretched vision. He is a fledgling, caught in a brush fire, forced forward by nature's blind laws towards a fate he comprehends but never quite believes until the final trump is played and the last man falls. Nor is this man holy or God sanctified. The music of the spheres passes over him, through him, and is not heard. Though man, the scientist, can glimpse larger truths, even his marvelling is transitory. Stapledon was one of those intellects, vast and cool and unsympathetic, in H.G. Wells's unforgettable description of the Martians. Brian Aldiss terms this book and Starmaker great classical ontological epic prose poems, a precise and yet huge definition of what makes Stapledon so fascinating. These two books grip the imaginations of figures such as novelist Arthur C. Clarke and physicist Freeman Dyson. These men stand, along with their precursors, H.G. Wells and scientist J.D. Bernal, in a grand tradition of English thinkers who always strove toward the largest scale possible for their work. The particularly British tone to all their works has given a cool cast to the very way we think of the future. In this complete edition, the first in the United States, I would advise the reader to simply skip the first four parts and begin with The Fall of the First Men. This eliminates the antique quality of the book and also tempers the rather repetitive cycle of rise and fall that becomes rather monotonous. The book gathers and grows as it rolls forward, though achieving a sweeping beauty and moral resonance. I believe no one can remain unaffected as they near the end of our race, and ponder the issues that must afflict all knowing mortal beings. Great are the stars, and man is of no account to them. But when he is done, he will not be nothing, not as though he had never been, for he is eternally a beauty in the eternal form of things. Yet we do matter. Man himself, at the very least, is music, a brave theme that makes music also of its vast accompaniment, its matrix of storms and stars. Gregory Benford, December 15th, 1987. Preface. This is a work of fiction. I have tried to invent a story which may seem a possible, or at least not wholly impossible, account of the future of man, and I have tried to make that story relevant to the change that is taking place today in man's outlook. To romance of the future may seem to be indulgence in ungoverned speculation for the sake of the marvellous. Yet controlled imagination in this sphere can be a very valuable exercise for minds bewildered about the present and its potentialities. Today we should welcome and even study every serious attempt to envisage the future of our race, not merely in order to grasp the very diverse and often tragic possibilities that confront us, but also that we may familiarize ourselves with the certainty that many of our most cherished ideals would seem puerile to more developed minds. To romance of the far future, then, is to attempt to see the human race in its cosmic setting, and to mould our hearts to entertain new values. But if such imaginative construction of possible futures is to be at all potent, our imagination must be strictly disciplined. We must endeavour not to go beyond the bounds of possibility set by the particular state of culture within which we live. The merely fantastic has only minor power. Not that we should seek actually to prophesy what will as a matter of fact occur, for in our present state such prophecy is certainly futile, save in the simplest matters. We are not to set up as historians, attempting to look ahead instead of backwards. We can only select a certain thread out of the tangle of many equally valid possibilities. But we must select with a purpose. The activity that we are undertaking is not science, but art, and the effect that it should have on the reader is the effect that art should have. Yet our aim is not merely to create aesthetically admirable fiction. We must achieve neither mere history nor mere fiction, but myth. A true myth is one which, within the universe of a certain culture, living or dead, expresses richly and often perhaps tragically the highest admirations possible within that culture. A false myth is one which either violently transgresses the limits of credibility set by its own cultural matrix, or expresses admirations less developed than those of its culture's best vision. This book can no more claim to be true myth than true prophecy, but it is an essay in myth creation. The kind of future which is here imagined should not, I think, seem wholly fantastic, or at any rate not so fantastic as to be without significance to modern Western individuals who are familiar with the outlines of contemporary thought. Had I chosen matter in which there was nothing whatever of the fantastic, its very plausibility would have rendered it unplausible. For one thing at least is almost certain about the future, namely, that very much of it will be such as we should call incredible. In one important respect, indeed, I may perhaps seem to have strayed into barren extravagance. I have supposed an inhabitant of the remote future to be communicating with us of today. I have pretended that he has the power of partially controlling the operations of minds now living, and that this book is the product of such influence. Yet even this fiction is perhaps not wholly excluded by our thought. I might, of course, easily have omitted it without more than superficial alteration of the theme. But its introduction was more than a convenience. Only by some such radical and bewildering device could I embody the possibility that there may be more in time's nature than is revealed to us. Indeed, only by some such trick could I do justice to the conviction that our whole present mentality is but a confused and halting first experiment. If ever this book should happen to be discovered by some future individual, for instance, by a member of the next generation sorting out the rubbish of his predecessors, it will certainly raise a smile, for very much is bound to happen of which no hint is yet discoverable. And indeed, even in our generation, circumstances may well change so unexpectedly and so radically that this book may very soon look ridiculous. But no matter. We of today must conceive our relation to the rest of the universe as best we can. And even if our images must seem fantastic to future men, they may nonetheless serve their purpose today. Some readers, taking my story to be an attempt at prophecy, may deem it unwarrantably pessimistic. But it is not prophecy. It is myth, or an essay in myth. We all desire the future to turn out more happily than I have figured it. In particular, we desire our present civilization to advance steadily towards some kind of utopia. The thought that it may decay and collapse, and that all its spiritual treasure may be lost irrevocably, is repugnant to us. Yet this must be faced as at least a possibility. And this kind of tragedy, the tragedy of a race, must, I think, be admitted in any adequate myth. And so, while gladly recognizing that in our time there are strong seeds of hope as well as of despair, I have imagined for aesthetic purposes that our race will destroy itself. There is today a very earnest movement for peace and international unity, and surely with good fortune and intelligent management it may triumph. Most earnestly we must hope that it will. But I have figured things out in this book in such a manner that this great movement fails. I suppose it incapable of preventing a succession of national wars, and I permit it only to achieve the goal of unity and peace after the mentality of the race has been undermined. May this not happen! May the League of Nations, or some more strictly cosmopolitan authority, win through before it is too late! Yet let us find room in our minds and in our hearts for the thought that the whole enterprise of our race may be, after all, but a minor and unsuccessful episode in a vaster drama, which also, perhaps, may be tragic. American readers, if ever there are any, may feel that their great nation is given a somewhat unattractive part in this story. I've imagined the triumph of the cruder sort of Americanism over all that is best and most promising in American culture. May this not occur in the real world? Americans themselves, however, admit the possibility of such an issue, and will, I hope, forgive me for emphasizing it and using it as an early turning point in the long drama of man. Any attempt to conceive such a drama must take into account whatever contemporary science has to say about man's own nature and his physical environment. I've tried to supplement my own slight knowledge of natural science by pestering my scientific friends. In particular, I've been very greatly helped by conversation with Professors P.G.H. Boswell, J. Johnston, and J. Rice of Liverpool. But they must not be held responsible for the many deliberate extravagances which, though they serve a purpose in the design, may jar upon the scientific ear. To Dr. L. A. Reed, I'm much indebted for general comments, and to Mr. E. V. Ryu for many very valuable suggestions. To Professor and Mrs. L. C. Martin, who read the whole book in manuscript, I cannot properly express my gratitude for constant encouragement and criticism. To my wife's devastating sanity, I owe far more than she supposes. Before closing this preface, I would remind the reader that throughout the following pages, the speaker, the first person singular, is supposed to be not the actual writer, but an individual living in the extremely distant future. O.S. West Kirby, July 1930. Introduction by One of the Last Men. This book has two authors, one contemporary with its readers, the other an inhabitant of an age which they would call the distant future. The brain that conceives and writes these sentences lives in the time of Einstein. Yet I, the true inspirer of this book, I who have begotten it upon that brain, I who influence that primitive being's conception, inhabit an age which, for Einstein, lies in the very remote future. The actual writer thinks he's merely contriving a work of fiction. Though he seeks to tell a plausible story, he neither believes it himself nor expects others to believe it. Yet the story is true. A being, whom you would call a future man, has seized the docile but scarcely adequate brain of your contemporary and is trying to direct its familiar processes for an alien purpose. Thus, a future epoch makes contact with your age. Listen patiently, for we, who are the last men, earnestly desire to communicate with you, who are members of the first human species. We can help you, and we need your help. You cannot believe it. Your acquaintance with time is very imperfect, and so your understanding of it is defeated. But no matter. Do not perplex yourselves about this truth, so difficult to you, so familiar to us of a later aeon. Do but entertain merely as a fiction the idea that the thought and will of individuals future to you may intrude rarely and with difficulty into the mental processes of some of your contemporaries. Pretend that you believe this, and that the following chronicle is an authentic message from the last men. Imagine the consequences of such a belief. Otherwise I cannot give life to the great history which it is my task to tell. When your writers romance of the future, they too easily imagine a progress towards some kind of utopia in which beings like themselves live in unmitigated bliss among circumstances perfectly suited to a fixed human nature. I shall not describe any such paradise. Instead, I shall record huge fluctuations of joy and woe, the results of changes not only in man's environment, but in his fluid nature. And I must tell how, in my own age, having at last achieved spiritual maturity and the philosophic mind, man is forced by an unexpected crisis to embark on an enterprise both repugnant and desperate. I invite you, then, to travel in imagination through the eons that lie between your age and mine. I ask you to watch such a history of change, grief, hope, and unforeseen catastrophe as has nowhere else occurred within the girdle of the Milky Way. But first, it is well to contemplate for a few moments the mere magnitudes of cosmical events. For, compressed as it must necessarily be, the narratives that I have to tell may seem to present a sequence of adventures and disasters crowded together with no intervening peace. But in fact, man's career has been less like a mountain torrent hurtling from rock to rock than a great sluggish river, broken very seldom by rapids. Ages of quiescence, often of actual stagnation, filled with the monotonous problems and toils of countless, almost identical lives, have been punctuated by rare moments of racial adventure. Nay, even these few seemingly rapid events themselves were in fact often long drawn out and tedious. They acquire a mere illusion of speed from the speed of the narrative. The receding depths of time and space, though they can indeed be haltingly conceived even by primitive minds, cannot be imaged save by beings of a more ample nature. A panorama of mountains appears to naive vision almost as a flat picture, and the starry void is a roof pricked with light. Yet in reality, while the immediate terrain could be spanned in an hour's walking, the skyline of peaks holds within it plain beyond plain. Similarly with time. While the near past and the near future display within them depth beyond depth, time's remote immensities are foreshortened into flatness. It is almost inconceivable to simple minds that man's whole history should be but a moment in the life of the stars, and that remote events should embrace within themselves eon upon eon. In your day you have learnt to calculate something of the magnitudes of time and space. But to grasp my theme in its true proportions, it is necessary to do more than calculate. It is necessary to brood upon these magnitudes, to draw out the mind toward them, to feel the littleness of your here and now, and of the moment of civilization which you call history. You cannot hope to image, as we do, such vast proportions as one in 1,000,000,000, because your sense organs, and therefore your perceptions, are too coarse-grained to discriminate so small a fraction of their total field. But you may at least, by mere contemplation, grasp more constantly and firmly the significance of your calculations. Men of your day, when they look back into the history of their planet, remark not only the length of time, but also the bewildering acceleration of life's progress. Almost stationary in the earliest period of the Earth's career, in your moment it seems headlong. Mind in you, it is said, not merely stands higher than ever before in respect of percipience, knowledge, insight, delicacy of admiration and sanity of will, but also it moves upward century by century ever more swiftly. What next? Surely you think there will come a time when there will be no further heights to conquer. This view is mistaken. You underestimate even the foothills that stand in front of you, and never suspect that far above them, hidden by cloud, rise precipices and snowfields. The mental and spiritual advances which in your day mind in the solar system has still to attempt are overwhelmingly more complex, more precarious and dangerous than those which have already been achieved. And though in certain humble respects you have attained full development, the loftier potencies of the spirit in you have not yet even begun to put forth buds. Somehow, then, I must help you to feel not only the vastness of time and space, but also the vast diversity of mind's possible modes. But this I can only hint to you, since so much lies wholly beyond the range of your imagination. Historians living in your day need grapple only with one moment of the flux of time. But I have to present in one book the essence not of centuries, but of eons. Clearly we cannot walk at leisure through such a tract in which a million terrestrial years are but as a year is to your historians. We must fly. We must travel as you do in your aeroplanes, observing only the broad features of the continent. But since the flyer sees nothing of the minute inhabitants below him, and since it is they who make history, we must also punctuate our flight with many descents, skimming, as it were, over the housetops, and even alighting at critical points to speak face to face with individuals. And as the plane's journey must begin with a slow ascent from the intricate pedestrian view to wider horizons, so we must begin with a somewhat close inspection of that little period which includes the culmination and collapse of your own primitive civilization.